Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Forged in Fire, where we explore how LGBTQ+ leaders develop their leadership superpowers. You'll hear from guests as they share how they navigated their journey through adverse and crucible experiences to develop into amazing leaders. Forged in Fire is hosted by Lieutenant Colonel Bree Fram and Dr. Liz Cavallaro.
Hi, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Bree Fram. I'm an astronautical engineer in the United States Space Force and one of the senior transgender officers in the military. I'm a passionate advocate for the value inclusion brings to organizations.
And I'm Dr. Liz Cavallaro. I'm an adult development scholar and associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College. I'm also an experienced researcher, interviewer, leader development practitioner, and professional executive coach. Please join us as we discover the inspiring stories of how LGBTQ+ leaders are forged.
Welcome to another episode of Forged in Fire. Today, we're honored to be joined by Lieutenant General Leah Lauterbach. She is the Deputy Chief of Staff for Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance and Cyber Effects Operations at the headquarters of the U.S. Air Force. She leads seven directorates and supports a 73,000-person enterprise across the Air Force with a portfolio valued at $72 billion. She was commissioned as an officer in 1993 from Clemson University, and her career spans through strategic, tactical, and operational levels of war throughout the Pacific, Central, and European theaters of operation, having commanded at the wing, group, and squadron levels. Lieutenant General Lauterbach also had a lead role in standing up the U.S. Space Command and the U.S. Space Force as the first senior intelligence officer for both organizations. She's been married to her wife, Brenda, for 9 years, having met in Newport, Rhode Island, where I met Liz, and they've been through 5 moves since then. A native Ohioan, she now claims Fairfax, Virginia, in the D.C. suburbs as home. She's a passionate sports fan, including baseball, women's soccer, women's basketball, and football. General Lauterbach, we're so thrilled to have you join us today.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
You know, we were really excited to get you on the show for a number of reasons, not just the fact that you are a leader of so many and so many different things with so many accomplishments, but that you're the first ever openly LGBTQ person to achieve your rank. And I know there are a lot of people, myself included, that look up to you. So we're really interested in digging into your story of how you got there. And I know Liz is dying to throw off the first question.
Thanks so much for being with us. And we definitely want to hear about your journey and the period of time under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and then afterward. But we'd like to start by going back a little bit earlier and maybe look a bit at even childhood and early life. What were some of the beginning phases, particularly in your journey as an LGBTQ individual, which is what we look at here in terms of how that forms who you are today? And so what is it that you experienced early on that might have informed the leader you are today?
Okay. Well, thank you. I would have to say that as a child, I was always a tomboy. I did not understand myself, until really I was in my mid-20s. So I guess I would have to say that, the fact that I had like 5 or 6 boyfriends or 9 or 10, whatever it was, and none of them I could make happen, right? A relationship work for over 3 months kind of clued me in at some point that, okay, this is just not right. So I can't say that from a childhood standpoint or teenage years, there was much, quite honestly, that helped me from an LGBTQ perspective to become, the person that I am today. I will tell you that I moved, I will never forget this, 1997. I was a brand new captain. I moved to North Carolina to Seymour Johnson Air Force Base. And up until that point, I was, I'd only dated men. And like I said, was not something that I was very successful at. I met this woman as soon as I got there, and she just really intrigued me. And so I told myself, okay, I'm just going to take a leap of faith and try to see if this is something. She and I ended up being together for, I think it was 8 years. So it was something certainly for a long period of time. I would tell you from that experience, and it's not just the only experience I've had in my life, but it's a matter of, you know, taking that leap of faith, taking a risk, jumping into something that you might not be all that comfortable with, but see how it works out. And I can say that, you know, that and a couple of other instances in my career have, you know, helped me to understand that, yes, we do have to get out of our comfort zone. I don't know if you've ever heard the phrase, be comfortable being uncomfortable. Very much from a senior leader perspective, I would say that is something that is, understood that's got to be a skill that you get. And there are only times in your childhood and your teenage years and your young adult life where you get to actually practice that skill. So I guess I got to practice that in my mid-20s, if you will.
So it's fascinating that you describe it as a leap of faith when you took that first step, and it wasn't like a revelatory moment. It was just, I'm going to try this out. Is that how it felt? Or was there some introspection that went on of, hey, maybe this is right? Was there a societal view that all of a sudden you could say, well, that told me one thing, maybe that's not right? Was there some sort of digging into yourself that happened before you were actually willing to take that leap?
I can't say that there was. I mean, it's one of those things, I think, where you, when you have an attraction to somebody, it's really hard to, be thinking about what are, what's everything else behind that. And maybe I just didn't care, right? So if you have an attraction to somebody that, it just, something else takes over. So for me, as a leap of faith, I mean, I really was not around a lot of the LGBTQ community. I mean, I didn't grow up that way. I didn't know anybody in my family, minus one cousin who also in her mid-20s decided to, get out of a long-term relationship with her husband at the time, and then started dating a woman. And so that was the only example that I had. I will say, my girlfriend then at the time, or who I started to date, it took a couple of months for me to feel comfortable. But honestly, I was hanging out with the softball team playing softball. And if anybody knows anything about women's softball, at least in the military, that's where you can kind of find a lot of your family members, right? So that certainly was helpful to be able to talk through things with some of the new friends that I was making there in North Carolina.
I'm curious about that experience of not necessarily having an example to follow or a clear path forward of something that you could look at and say, okay, I can model where I'm about to go after that example. And what parallels have you seen, perhaps at other junctures in your life, and particularly your leadership journey, where it kind of goes to what you were saying before about the leap of faith or being out of your comfort zone, where even though in the military there may be many pre-described things and there be many clear paths, there are also these examples where there is no clear path and you really are taking that risk and forging your own path forward. What have you seen in that way in your leadership?
Yes, I would say that, there's a number of examples I could give you from being a woman in the military. Certainly, my very first deployment that I went on was Army heavy, and there were just a couple of us Air Force. I think I was the only Air Force officer, and then I had an Air Force technical sergeant that was traveling with me. And I remember being told by the Army captain, I was a lieutenant at the time, by the Army captain that I wasn't allowed to go outside the wire because I was a woman. I found a different way to get outside the wire. And it happened. I mean, it was something necessity for the job that I needed to be able to go do that. Concerned, fearful, anxious, about going outside the wire and ensuring that I was going to, still be successful. So it was, I won't say the leap of faith, but it was again, getting outside of your comfort zone. I mean, I'm an Air Force officer, right? I'm not a soldier. And so getting outside the wire, you know, this was, I don't know, 27 years ago, that wasn't necessarily something that an Air Force member did. And so, so for me, and certainly as a woman on that deployment, it was in Sarajevo, not in the desert, but out in Sarajevo, Bosnia Herzegovina. And that to me was a clear and really brought me forward from a job perspective, right? I mean, actually understanding what it is that I was doing, getting out of the comfort zone, leading in the mission that we were leading, that we were executing. I mean, all of those things made me, helped propel me in my professional development. There are times in my career where I was the only woman at the table. I was the only woman in the squadron, right? In a fighter squadron. I still have folks today, guys today, men that I was stationed with, again, 25, 26 years ago. And Leah, how are you? And I apologize because I can't remember them. I was the only woman out of, right, the 35 people in that squadron. And so they immediately, of course, understood or remembered me. And I, you know, I don't have a good memory of meeting all of the men. I remember distinctly that was at Kunsan Air Base. And there were probably 5,000 people on base. And there were about 10 to 15 female officers total, right? So I've been in those uncomfortable positions many times. And honestly, it's like repetition just makes you better, right? Repetition is a good thing. And so you just get more used to being in those uncomfortable positions and then understanding what your role might be.
So an uncomfortable position a lot of people find themselves in is the closet. Now it's almost unique in a lot of the people we've spoken with didn't have a personal closet or a societal closet. But when you came out, you had to go into a government-imposed closet. So it's kind of a unique journey of development. And why I want to explore that is because as you came out, you know, you couldn't to certain people or to certain public spaces, but you managed to find a friend at every base that you were at. How did that kind of affect your philosophy towards risk management? How did it affect your ability to connect with people? Was there an extra step you had to take in figuring out who, when, why to come out?
Yes, 100%. Having to, it wasn't a matter of coming out to somebody quickly. I mean, it took time. In the military, we of course build bonds and linkages, and then personnel, and we see each other regularly. Like in the community that I'm in, and within intelligence, I could see my friends, you know, two times a year or six times in 2 years, whatever it is. And immediately we have a bond, and we just get back to what we were talking about, right, 6 months ago type of thing. So building that trust and the friendships that I had was very important. I absolutely needed to find somebody that I could speak with that knew my secret in every location that I went to. And just so the readers or the listeners here understand is that the reason for that was because, one, I would say my peace of mind. I am somebody that just, you know, right, I wear my heart on my sleeve. I am pretty open, transparent. And so I need to have conversations with folks about like that. Two is the, in a deployed setting, nobody back at Vegas where, you know, Nellis Air Force Base, as an example, knew that I had a roommate, right? Knew that I had a girlfriend. And so, I needed to make sure that she got called if something was happening. Likewise, and this happened one time where, she was in a car accident, and our friends were there called upon, to comfort her and be with her and make sure she was okay. which he was. But they immediately contacted me because my girlfriend was unable to do that, right? So, I mean, just for all of those reasons that you had to have, I had to have somebody. And I feel so bad for people that did not have that during Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I can't even understand how folks wouldn't be able to come out to one or two people, but I know that's the case for many. One of my dear friends, I mean, she was probably 15 years my senior, and so I will tell you that when I did, you know, figure myself out and come out, I met her about 3 years after that, and then she became an immediate mentor to me. She was already someone who was a lieutenant colonel at the time, perhaps even a colonel, I can't remember, and so she told me of here are the things that we had to go through before Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which I feel that was worse. But then in Don't Ask, Don't Tell, still the precautions that you had to take. I mean, I remember putting, we would go out to the local gay bar and have to put tape on the window, on our car window windshield of the military decal, right? So because we knew at some point, the Office of Special Investigations was going around to gay bars and seeing who was there and who wasn't, kind of thing. So still had to have some tradecraft to make sure that we were a little secret. What I would like to say that, you know, during this time, it was so hard for me from an integrity standpoint. And I absolutely chose to risk my integrity during those many years, and that was tough, and it was tough even later when I would get questioned about it, because some people believe that integrity, and you know, it's all in your definition of integrity, but some people take that integrity as that hey, if you know it's a chunk of armor, and if you take a little bit out of that armor is never the same, and you can never get it back. And I felt like, gosh, I mean, we are absolutely putting all of these people in this precarious position who, you know, you're asking them to be secret, to not be who they are. And that was so hard to overcome. And I've said this publicly, like, I mean, there's not a day or a week, I would say that I don't look back on that time with disdain, quite honestly, because of the integrity that I felt that I had, that I compromised. And I know that, you know, I'll be on my deathbed still probably thinking about it. Because of course I pride myself in being, you know, in one of the core values of being an Air Force, an airman is integrity first. And I do believe in that, but I decided to make this conscious decision, because I also knew that I am right. I'm human. I needed to be me. I thought that I would be a better officer. Lo and behold, I think that I was, and I became a better officer for the thing, you know, right, for these reasons, these difficulties that we lived through. But it was, that was a very difficult time, and you can hear it in my voice, right? Even as I'm talking to you about it, it's not something that I look upon fondly by any means. I don't know if that was an answer to your question or not, but we'll go with it.
We can certainly circle back to some of those things because there's a lot to cover there. But yeah, when you talked about covering up the military decal, I mean, that hit hard to think about the things so many of us have done to cover something that should never need to be covered.
And certainly the level of detail in your, you know, scanning the environment and thinking through these additional pieces, it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of effort. It surely is draining. But we also, you know, hear a lot of really interesting examples about the way in which that develops certain skill sets and the way in which that actually can augment and contribute to some of the things that you do as a leader. And the other piece that stood out to me in that I wonder how it impacted you as a leader is simply that acute awareness that people need someone to talk to. They need to be able to have that connection, and they need to be able to be their true, authentic self and bring that to work. How is it that you have incorporated that understanding into your own leadership and helped provide that to others, regardless of whether they're in the LGBT community or anyone else that you've supported?
Yes. Yeah. I will say that the connection to have with people, you know, we talk about people being our greatest asset in the Air Force. I think we, you know, throughout the Department of Defense, and we know it's true. We need to, as part of that, in taking care of our folks, giving them the right tools, the right training, the opportunities to fail, whatever it might be. Part of that is a connection with them on a level that that we can understand where they're coming from, and then maybe where the leadership is coming from. I mean, it wasn't always this way, but I have very much prided myself over the last number of years that I just try to be approachable so that I can get a connection with someone. Like we're all family, right? We're all, and I don't mean that in the LGBTQ sense, like in the military sense, we're family. And sometimes families, you know, right, we disagree with one another. Sometimes we get into arguments. But the underlying sense is that we love each other. We take care of each other. And so you can't take care of somebody if they are constantly having to lie about what they did on the weekend or who they are seeing, right? So many times that I would come into the office and my friends would ask me, like, what'd you do over the weekend? Oh, I went to the movies by myself, right? Like, ah, my God, you sound right. That doesn't sound right. And it wasn't right. Just put into those situations, that's not a connection that at all, right? We connected perhaps other ways. I connected with other, friends in other ways, but they never truly knew me. And so today, in the last 10 years since the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I absolutely want to understand, who is your significant other? And is that, is it your furry, four-legged furry friend? Is it your, a boyfriend, a girlfriend? It does not matter. I also learned a long time ago that, don't judge, just support. And so I think that's very important for our leadership I think that our folks are like getting there. You know, this is taking time, lots of time, but when I have opportunities to talk to senior leaders, those are the things, that's something that I bring up. You can't be well connected with somebody if you're judging who it is that they're married to. And they would absolutely agree with that. So you just have to let that go, that judgment go, and understand that you're supporting them, and that's okay. I mean, right. So I very much believe in the connection, and I think that it helped me to become a better officer later in life, as a major, lieutenant colonel, to understand what difficulties people were going through in my, in my squadron or in the group or in the wing for that matter. So, just trying to always push that you can't, all right, it's really hard to support somebody if you don't know who they are and what they're about.
Now, whether the closet was a personal one or the government-imposed version, a lot of people describe that as almost living with a heavy cloak on that prevents you from showing your authentic self to the world. And when Don't Ask, Don't Tell ended, you had the opportunity to take off that cloak, to reconcile that lack of having integrity first with now being open and being able to have that. Despite that opportunity, was it still difficult to take that cloak off? Did you struggle with it for a while, or was it bang, I'm me?
No, I struggled. I have to say, even before the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I'll tell you a story here where, I could see the tide was changing I could come out to more people. There were still some people that I absolutely knew I could not come out to, and I would not until Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. I had a squadron commander, and I was a captain, I think, and I was out at Nellis Air Force Base. So this is probably 2002, close to 2003 timeframe. And that squadron commander, asked me. We were at a graduation ceremony and at the O Club, right? And if you can imagine, the O Club at Nellis Air Force Base, fighter pilot base, was pretty crazy. And and there were mostly fighter pilots, so 90% of the crowd is men. And I remember my squadron commander asking me, Leah, don't you see any of these guys that you'd like to date or be with? And I said, no, sir. No, I don't. And he said, well, do you see any women here that you'd like to date or be with? And I said, sir, I'm good. Thank you very much. Thank you. I don't think that he was trying to be a jerk and to out me by any means. And, you know, knowing the man and many years later, having talked about it, I mean, he honestly was trying to make that connection, right? He was, I couldn't do it, but I think he understood by my answer. And I think I understood by his question that he probably already knew. So bottom line is that I saw the tide changing over the years. It just took quite a while for the policy, right, to catch up. So back to the question of did I come out and unveil myself, take off the cloak completely in 2011? The answer is no. I would say, you know, I was at Newport, Rhode Island at this time in the Naval War College. And so I didn't know a lot of folks, and it was a joint environment. So there's many more Army and Navy personnel there, as well as international. And so there is a certain amount of protection that I do for myself, and I still do it today, especially when I go overseas and not knowing if I do know the culture, right, or not knowing those people specifically, I won't share my story by any means. I won't shy away from it if somebody asks me, but I won't go forward. So there are still times today that I absolutely am still protective of myself. Not that I need to be, and I don't know. Boy, you guys could tell me, like, you know, help me as a therapist to get over that. And how do you? But I'll tell you another story. Is this was 2017, sorry. And so now I'm a one star and I'm deployed to Iraq and Kuwait. And I'm with the Army, primarily again with the Army, but it's a combined joint task force, Operation Inherent Resolve. And so that's the defeat ISIS mission over in Iraq and Syria. And so I am, I'm the only female general officer. Most of the general officers are Army, like, you know, 50-60% probably. And then, a couple of us Air Force officers, a couple of, naval officers, and one French general officer. Anyway, so we're all working for the three star and, who's a great guy, three star, Army general officer. And he says, his thing in order to make a connection with people, is that on Friday nights, all the general officers have to eat together. And when we all eat together, then we have to tell stories from home. That scared the crud out of me, right? I mean, I got to tell stories about Brenda and me and our two cats. I mean, I struggled with what to come up with because I wasn't ready to come out to everybody. And I wasn't ready to come out in this social setting at the chow hall with all of these general officers who I barely knew. But anyways, the bottom line is that I did it. I guess I took that leap of faith, or I was comfortable being uncomfortable. So I told some story about Brenda and the cats, and nobody really batted an eyelash. I mean, it just seemed like, okay, right? Like, I mean, you know, who knows? Maybe half of them have a gay member in their, you know, in their family. I don't really know. But it was a good experience for me while it was still concerning there and fearful in the beginning. Over the course of that year, I mean, I would have multiple one-on-one conversations with these general officers about my life and what I was experiencing and all that kind of good stuff. It was interesting to me, though, that we never had the conversation with more than a one-on-one. I think that was to make them feel comfortable and they were, you know, thinking that I would be more comfortable in that setting. Okay. So fast forward, maybe 3 years after that, and now we're in COVID. And so we did a Zoom call among all of those general officers And we did a Zoom call just to check in on everybody, see how everybody was doing. And Brenda sat next to me on the Zoom call. And I was able to introduce Brenda to all of my compatriots and friends. And I got an email, 30 minutes later or whatever, from the Lieutenant General, the Army, who was the commanding officer. And he just wrote, "I am so proud of you. Wonderful to meet Brenda." You know, I mean, it was just, it just made me feel so good. So, so I feel like when I came out, after Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed, and I did not come out immediately, other than to small numbers of groups of people, my big coming out, I will say, was, when I was giving up group command. I was in group command for 2 years after Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. And it was, Brenda had moved down to Texas with me. We lived off base, and we were waiting to, actually move to Ohio next. That was our, where I was going to take wing command. So at the group command change of command, this is me giving up command. I introduced Brenda, and you could have seen, like, there were so many people who were just staring at me like, "What?" You know, I had not really ever spoken of her. Or not much. It was just in small, very small circles. So anyhow, that's when I came out big, and I had to, because I was going to go take wing command, and I needed to, be that authentic self. So when I took wing command, a month after Brenda and I got married, we knew that we needed to get married. I mean, one, we loved each other, so it wasn't a hardship, but we had to live on base. I needed to live on base as the wing commander, and I needed, Brenda to have an ID card, so that we could live on base together. Of course, we couldn't get married in Texas, and we couldn't get married in Ohio either at the time. So we went out to California, got married, and after that, 30 days after that, essentially moved up to Ohio, at the wing command, the ceremony. I mean, this is where, you know, there's probably 2,000 people there. And then that's when I had to, you know, not had to, but I got to, I guess I should say, introduce Brenda as my wife. And, honestly, the journey started. As soon as I got off the stage, I had an interview with the Dayton Daily News reporter, who of course asked me right then. And then it was, you know, are you the first gay commander of NASIC? I chuckled and I said, well, I'm the first openly gay commander of NASIC. Right. And then, on the front page, first gay commander, right. It was hilarious. Anyways, that was something in, that was a big coming out. I will tell you also there that I muted that reception, if you will. There were a lot of opportunities that I had to for interviews and whatnot that first year, and I told all of the reporters and folks that I am not going to do this in the first 6, 8, 9 months because I really needed to build my credibility as a commander, as a wing commander, and it wasn't about me being gay that got me the job. It was, you know, my capabilities as an officer, as a leader. And so that was very important to me. I won't say I went back into the closet by any means, because I talked about it whenever anybody had a question. But I did not do anything until the second year of really, you know, coming out any more than I had already.
So many examples of, you know, having been the first, and the attention that you receive and the responsibility that comes with that. And of course, even now, being the first to achieve this rank, and the example that you've been able to serve for others and the work that you've done in this space to help support others. A couple of things really stood out to me in what you were talking about. One was that example of, you know, how do I get over that need to self-protect? And I think what's interesting about that is one of many themes that Bree and I have found in our work is fairly universal to this sort of experiment of trying to be an adult, right? Trying to be a person in this world. And I think so many of us can learn from your example, not only those that are members of the community. But you also mentioned that, you know, there were these periods of time where there were some people who you just knew you couldn't come out to. And it was just clear to you that that wasn't an option and you had to make that choice. And I know in some of the work you've done more recently, you've talked about not only, of course, the need to change policy and put the education and support in place formally, but also the journey to influence and change hearts and minds. And so what are the things that you've had the opportunity to do and how have you utilized your story or other stories to have that kind of influence and impact where those hearts and minds really need to be changed?
Yeah. Okay. So if I can answer that through in two ways. One, the hearts and minds of the people, and specifically in the LGBTQ family, that they don't need their hearts and minds changed, right? They need their hearts heard. And so from that perspective, I mean, I would be happy to talk about the LGBTQ initiatives team that we started in the Air Force. And I can get into that if you would like to. But I mean, yes, wanted to build a forum for which we could have a community outreach, if nothing else. I wanted to be able to have that. But then also we needed to move forward with some changes. Speaking of, I mean, I will tell you that Bree was one of the first folks that I spoke with when we were standing up the lit, because I wanted to understand the transgender community. And I didn't. It was not opening up my hearts and minds, but well, my mind, I will say that. Yes. You know, right. It was an education for me. I was so grateful that Bree and a few other of our transgender members were able to, I mean, just sat down with me and frankly told me what it is that they were dealing with, what their challenges were. That was amazing to me. And so Bree is always one of my, you know, like I'm a fan of hers, right? No doubt. And I'm so glad that she's doing things like this. It's just amazing. I would tell you, okay, so the other hearts and minds of people that I think do need to change from that aspect. And this being a lieutenant general allows me the ability to do this with 4 stars, which is nice, right? I have had multiple 4 stars have a one-on-one conversation with me about, well, what does this mean? What does that mean? What, you know, I mean, help me, because they want to be supportive. And I think that they, I mean, it's obvious that they trust me to be able to tell them, the truth or just explain it in a way that they aren't going to feel, that they won't feel, strange, right? Or embarrassed. So I'm absolutely grateful that I have that opportunity to educate a lot of 4 stars, 3 stars. It doesn't matter how many stars, and then our senior civilians at the same level. It's really a privilege to be able to do that. I think I've answered the question in two parts there. It's the hearts and minds of the folks that need the changing, and the hearts and minds of the folks that need to be heard.
Well, it is incredibly inspirational to have you at that rank, because the concept that if you can see it, you can be it, and hopefully that you can go even further for members of the community is so valuable. Representation truly matters. But I did want to talk a little bit about the lit before we wrap up, because I think it's illustrative of the way a community develops together. And what can be done when people can connect with like-minded folks, can come together and work with one another to advance things for everyone. And what I want to ask you about is, what makes you hopeful about that? What excites you about that? Because as you developed and grew as a leader, you didn't have that community around you. And now you see junior personnel who have the opportunity to grow within that community. What is it about that that is exciting to you?
Oh my gosh. That's a question of like, what is it that's exciting to me about it? I think a couple of things that out of the lit, we have, a number of areas, and you know this well, Bree, as to what we're trying to change, make it easier for the LGBTQ family to serve. There's just a lot of outdated policy that we have written that needs to change, needs to be updated. You know, we have lots of challenges still in our medical, in the medical corps that, you know, folks not understanding what it is that that a member of our family might need, or not wanting to help a member of our family that need a member of our family that is in need, which just, I mean, really makes me livid. I can't tell you how, if somebody has raised their hand for to, you know, potentially sacrifice their life for this nation, I really feel like we should be able to take care of all of us in the same, right, in this same stance, same capabilities that we have for each one of us. It's just, anyhow, you know, I could go on that for a couple of hours. I would say that the, you know, so we've got these policies and whatnot that need to be changed. That makes me hopeful for the future in that, again, anybody that wants to raise their hand to serve their nation will be able to do that, and they will have less difficulty and less challenges than you and I will have had in the military. So that makes me hopeful. That, I mean, excited for the future. That, you know, right? There's we shouldn't, you know, we're sometimes we constrain ourselves in the military for you know, what we think is tradition or what we think is the right thing. And it's just clearly it's the nation is changing. The public society is changing. We should really be changing with it. The other part about it is that, you know, we have a recruiting issue in all of the services. We're having a recruiting issue. And I think in the lit, you talked about some of the folks being able to come together and come up with solutions and ideas. I'm so excited for the future of the fact that we are recruiting at pride festivals, at pride parades, and actually getting people to sign up, you know, because they didn't think that the military was anything that they would want to or could serve in. And I think the military, I love serving. I love wearing the uniform. I mean, there was nothing else that I knew what I was going to be able to do with my life besides serve. And so serve in the military. So I just feel that there are many other people out there like me who, however, might not know that they can or that it's not as challenging as it once was type of thing. We definitely have work to do. So I'm really grateful for the team members in the lit who have come up with the, you know, a recruiting pitch and go out to the parades, even here in the DC Pride, you know, parade when it was whatever, 100 degrees outside and our folks are out there doing it. That was, that's just inspiring to me. And then I would say the other thing that makes, I mean, it's just so exciting for us. I mean, I get a lot of pleasure out of, people, you know, people being happy. And so I remember distinctly she was a staff sergeant. She was a guard member. She'd already served for 8 or 10 years. And after Don't Ask, Don't Tell had been repealed, right? I mean, this was a number of years after Don't Ask, Don't Tell had been repealed. And she still hadn't come out to her, to the work, you know, to folks at the workshop or in her shop. And I think she was in maintenance. I can't remember, right? And so there was, anyways, I remember having a conversation with her and that she was concerned about it. We went through, I told her, hey, here's my perspective. The policy is on your side at this point. You can, you know, if you have the courage, you can come out. And if you think that something is going to be held against you, the policy is on your side. I can't promise that it will work out, but I also feel like, you know, perhaps you need to give the team a chance. I mean, you don't necessarily know exactly how they feel about it. And so I know she mulled that over and probably talked to, you know, a number of other folks, but I heard back from her later. She had, we were on a panel. There were a number of us that were on a panel the Women's Symposium. This is where I was introducing the lit. Telling my story and others were telling their stories. And so she had taped that and then she gave it to her supervisor, and they all watched it on the floor, right. In the, you know, at the shop, the maintenance shop. And they all, right. Everything turned out wonderfully for her. You know, they accepted her, they understood it. She wasn't having to hide, And so that, when I hear stories like that, I mean, it really just brings me to tears that people can have a good, can build that connection with their, the folks that they work with. I mean, we spend so much time with the folks that we work with. It would be nice to be able to have that connection with them like you do with friends out of work. And so for the staff sergeant, I was really, really proud of her. And I'm so happy that it came out in the, you know, the right way, the best way for her to be able to, expose that. And so those are the things, right, that I am excited about and that keeps me going. You know, Bree and Liz, it's it's hard work. It, you know, takes time. You get really frustrated when you can't change the policy. You've got to, you know, go through, you know, years of to be able to change things. But we just can't. We just have to continue. We just have to be persistent and understanding that at the end, just like a number of us felt that, okay, at one point, don't ask, don't tell will be repealed. And for me, it was, you know, like 14 years later. But for others, it had been longer, right? And so in the end, if it doesn't take us persisting and advocating and leading, then, you know, I don't know who else is going to do it. So those are the things that get me excited for the future.
Well, we so wholeheartedly agree with all of those things. And we're really excited about those opportunities as well. And in our work, you know, we like to think about what are the opportunities for us to contribute? How can we help advance these causes? And we like to ask our participants, what is it that made you say yes to participating in this? And what is it that you would like to see out of it? What would you hope to see for us to be able to do going forward?
Oh, got it. Well, yes, I said yes because, you know, Bree told me that I had to. No, I'm totally kidding. Totally kidding. No, I want to be, yes, I want to be an advocate. I want to, you know, and if it's that, I feel like, quite honestly, sharing my story, gosh, it's not all that exciting. You know, I never thought of it as, I never thought of myself as a leader in this space until really just a few years ago when I felt like, okay, I've got this rank. I should be using it to help, and to advocate and to change. And so, but I'm pretty humble about how I act and at work. And so to me, it's not all that interesting of a story, but if it helps anybody or just one or two people, I am, I'm happy to have that conversation. So that's really why I, continue to, you know, do podcasts and interviews and things of that nature that, again, if it's helping folks, I totally get it. I'm representing the family and I am representing at a 3-star level, which is not all that regular. So I think that, I mean, it's a responsibility that I have as well. And I feel that, and I'm happy to take it on. Absolutely. So out of a podcast like this, I listened to a few of your podcasts in preparation for today. And I love it. I love that you are dedicating your time. And this is not easy, right? And, you know, especially when you have technical issues and you have to redo the podcast kind of thing. And you're taking time away from your families to do this and dedicating that time and to this family and to advocate and educate. You are absolutely, you know, opening hearts and minds with things with these types of podcasts. So I don't know that I expect anything else out of it other than keep going and, you know, keep getting include myself, but keep getting these really interesting characters to do the podcast, because we can all learn from everywhere, right? Whether we're in the Department of Defense or a basketball coach or anything, right? So thank you for doing what you're doing. And I ask you to keep going.
Well, we absolutely will. And Lieutenant General Leah Lauterbach, thank you so much for joining us, because you definitely are one of those interesting characters. Your story has power, and I absolutely believe that it will inspire others to take that leap of faith. Just as you've seen already, there are so many more to come, and the results end up being amazing. So thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Forged in Fire is hosted by Bree Fram and Liz Cavallero. Produced and engineered by Frida Castellanos and Christina George. Guest management by Trey Worth and original music by Bridget Benemark. The views and ideas expressed by the hosts and guests of this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the organizations or institutions they represent. To learn more about Forged in Fire, please visit us at forgedinfire.org.